Welcome to Unique Connections at the Table. I'm Dr. Beverly Samways, and each episode we invite you to join the conversation and discover new ways of seeing the world, particularly in relation to those with learning disabilities. So pull up a chair, the table's set, and we're so glad you're here.
Hello, and welcome to Unique Connections at the Table. I'm Jen.
And I'm Bev.
And this is our podcast to talk a bit more about what it is that we do. Bev, would you like to tell us a bit more about what we say, Unique Connections at the Table? What table? Which table?
Yes.
This table?
Yeah. Yes, this table. This table that we are attempting to create and come around and bring other people around. So I guess we're both, our like common ground is we're both self-injury experts, but in different fields. You've mostly been working with young people in mainstream settings, and I've mostly worked with, or pretty exclusively worked with, young people in special needs settings, or particularly settings for people with severe learning disabilities. And I guess like where we continually come back to in our work is, so we often work with young people who are self-injuring and any organisations that support them. And in this particular space, there's a lot of talk about behaviour. There's a lot of talk about diagnosis, and there's not a great deal of talk around emotion or distress or trauma. And so we spend, I reckon, a lot of time thinking and talking and writing and working with the idea that not everyone, but some young people with learning disabilities who are really distressed, either because they're either hurting themselves or other people, it's not to do with something inside them, their diagnosis or their biology. And it's probably not quite fair to call it a behaviour. But really, we're talking about young people who are responding to the things that have happened to them. And so I guess that's what we think and talk about all the time.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because when we tell people what we do, so many people say, oh, of course. Of course there's trauma. Yeah. Of course young people will be impacted by the things within their history.
Yeah.
It's one of those, why did I not see this? Why did I not think about it? Which then raises up all the questions for us of why do we find it so difficult to talk about young people having experienced trauma?
Yeah.
Especially many of the young people that we work with who may present in a way, they may not find it very easy to talk about their story.
Yeah.
They may have communication difficulties that make it hard for them to say, and this happened to me, and this happened to me, and this is how I felt.
Yeah.
And we may also have a lot of staff who say, I just don't know how to have these conversations.
Absolutely. And I think so most of the young people that we get involved in have got little or no spoken communication, and something happens with those kids, like in how, terms of how they're understood and perceived. And we just end up with so many assumptions. And like, for if we compare like a child who could speak and a child who isn't currently speaking, what we then attach and how we make sense of that is wildly different. I'm thinking of when I first started my PhD and I was talking to another like really smart PhD guy, and he said, what's your research? And I was like, it's about self-injury, but self-injury presenting in people with learning disabilities and autism have no spoken communication. And he said, oh, I worked with a young man for about a year, and he would bang his head on the wall like quite a lot. He said, but it wasn't self-injury. I said, oh, what was it then? He said, oh, it's like a habit. It's like a bad habit. It was just part of his autism. I was like, in what sense was it not self-injury? As in, like, did he hurt himself? Oh, yeah, he definitely hurt himself. How was it not self-injury? He was like, well, he didn't mean it. It didn't have any meaning. And I found it like mind-blowing, like, and obviously just really struggled to stay in that conversation. But what I found incredible was, this is a really thoughtful guy it wasn't a flash in the pan. He had done that job for a year. He'd mostly worked with this young man, and his conclusion had been it was meaningless. And eventually, you know, I said to him, how did you come to believe that? How did you come to believe that it was meaningless? And he was like, well, everybody knew it was. We all knew it was meaningless. The whole school knew it was meaningless. His parents knew it was meaningless. And it's like that, like when a truth, no matter how bizarre, becomes universalized, it's like impossible to resist.
And I then get curious around what's the cost to all those people to consider there is a meaning?
Yeah. Yeah.
What purpose is it serving to say this is meaningless?
Yeah.
And we've come up against this so many times when we've worked with young people, when we've worked with organisations, that sometimes things will reach a crisis point with self-injury.
Yeah.
But actually we hear, whatever it looks like, perhaps it began with head banging at 2 years old, and
Yeah.
then it has grown, it's grown, it's grown.
Yeah.
But yet nobody stopped at 2, 3, 4, 5 years old and said, hang on, let's get curious, what's going on here?
Yeah. Yeah.
And suddenly we reach a crisis when somebody's reached late teenagehood, early adulthood of, oh, actually, we've got no idea how to hold this and how to handle this as an organisation.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's important to note this isn't actually something that we're just facing in the UK.
No.
And I know sort of other countries are exploring and questioning, and teams are in other places as well. And that's sort of part of your interest as well, is what's happened elsewhere and how else it is that people are talking about this.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you want to tell us a little bit about kind of what happened in America. How did you end up going to America? Because I think this is fascinating. Of all the countries, actually a mammoth country like the USA, and how they're wrestling with the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is my so I had a Churchill fellowship, so the Winston Churchill Foundation, it gives these traveling grants to people to go all around, like you can go wherever you want to and find out about like a niche topic like this. So I was Churchill Fellow 2024 and had 5 weeks on the East Coast in America. And had this incredible opportunity. I mean, in the end I just decided to, like, under the advice of a lady called Dr. Joni Beasley, just like hit up a bunch of different spaces and places. So I went into like practice spaces, so schools and adult centres, and then also went to a number of trauma institutes where they think about trauma, particularly with organisations at a really deep level. Went and met some research specialists in this field. I also went to a specialist hospital, spent a few days in a specialist hospital in Baltimore that specialises with young people with intellectual disabilities and complex presentations. Met a lot of people whose research and writing I've been like reading for years and years. It was absolutely fascinating. And I think I wanted to go to America because I was conscious that some writing was coming out of there, at least, that was interesting. So even that there's a researcher who is now a good friend of mine, Dr. John Kiesler, who's been writing about trauma and intellectual disabilities for the last more than 10 years. He hasn't got loads of company in doing that, but certainly is at the forefront of that.
And just for ourselves, like 10 years, 10 years he's been writing about it.
Yeah.
And that feels wild, doesn't it? Because I've been working within mainstream organisations and young people talking about links between self-harm and trauma for a really long time, like much longer than 10 years. Does it feel like within the learning disability world, it's been talked about less, or were other people also talking about it before him?
Yeah, much less. Much. So I think he's the first person to publish research on it. Yeah, I know. It's really,
That feels wild, doesn't it?
I know. Well, but it is a really odd space. Like, so the idea of talking about behavior and learning disability has become so dominant. Like, that's what everybody wants, a behavior plan and behavior management. And if you look on NICE guidelines or any best practice guidance, they are talking about behavior, and that in a quite to the really exclusion of everything else. And I just don't think we do that to anybody else. Like, we don't. I mean, we do talk about behavior and people behaving and all that kind of stuff, but it's become so full on in that setting that you can have somebody with learning disability who's crying and distressed, and it will be described as a behavior rather than an emotion. So it's really hard to get out of that, like, conversation, because people like, and that's then becomes a limit on thinking about trauma and emotion, because there's always this, like, get out clause where people are like, I don't know, that is it trauma or is it just behavior? Is it just a challenging behavior? And so it's hard to get the conversation going. It's hard to get people around the
Is there a table in the
table. No table. We're making the table so we can talk about
place?
it.
Do you think other people are talking about it in the UK in the same kind of way?
So there's, like, pockets. So there's a few organisations that are absolutely talking about it, and but I do worry that it's a much smaller. So as I find those connections, I usually get really excited about them, but I do worry that actually we're just a very, very tiny echo chamber. So in fact, I'm writing a paper with the two guys at the moment who are in this space, and one of them forwarded another paper around these issues of trauma and learning disability onto both of us, and I realized that all three of us have been cited in this paper. So I put them back and was like, are we just in a very small echo chamber, very small number of people who are all talking about this, citing each other? And there's a few organizations that would be taking that up with some force. So, like, Respond is an organization, does psychotherapy with people with learning disabilities. They're, like, all over this stuff. And then there's a lot more talk. So, I was reading something yesterday, and it talked about, like, thinking about trauma in the context of behavior. So there's lots of attempts to sort of bring those two together. And that's progress. I just don't think it's going far enough. So actually, what I ended up doing in the US was going into spaces where they're really, really well versed in trauma, how it presents in individuals and organisations, but they weren't necessarily in learning disability spheres, just so that I could begin to understand that at a much more comprehensive level.
And I know that we're going to be talking about the trauma in organisations at another time. So I kind of don't want to pick that up too much. I feel like that can be like our trailer for another episode when it
We
is
need
that
to
we do
talk
that.
about that.
But I think it's really fascinating. And this is one of those things that's really struck me is the idea of traumatized organizations. And I've especially noticed it. I work privately as a psychotherapist, and I will have maybe five clients who all work at the same organisation. And they will all say, this organisation tries to support me but doesn't know how to. It tries to listen, but actually stuff's blocked down. And these will be like the big organisations that will have thousands of employees. And I kind of want to be like, oh, but I bet a trauma-informed organisation, they're going to have a really different approach to this. They're gonna like all their staff are gonna have this amazing understanding, and they're gonna understand themselves, and they're gonna be emotionally literate about themselves and how they regulate. But I know from some of those conversations that we had that that wasn't always the case.
No.
And I wonder if you've got kind of any stories around some of the staff supporting young people, or around some of the leadership and that dichotomy of how do we infiltrate this trauma-informed approach throughout the whole organisation.
Yeah, and that's the goal, isn't it? We probably need to like spend like an episode on that. But yeah, I guess that was part of what I went over to into the US to think about, was this idea that like trauma leaks, I guess it gets into all sorts of different spaces and places, and if the less it's thought about, almost the less it can be contained. So there's a real danger to supporting, you know, to an organisation supporting, say they're supporting 20 or 30 young people with severe learning disabilities, and maybe a third of those are in some kind of traumatised state, but no one can name it, no one can explain that that's what's happening. And so what happens is it's almost like uncontained fear has to go somewhere, and so it starts to go into the staff teams and then into the organisations, and that does present in these like fairly chaotic ways, often with just a real struggle to think for an organisation to think well. So maybe we should just talk about like what happens when a person's, I think it's helpful to think about like what happens when a person's in a traumatized state, and what that looks and feels like. Maybe we'll just like nail that down, and then we can talk in another episode about how that looks for wider spaces and for teams and organizations. So how would you describe
I think my favourite is from Dr. Daniel Siegel, where his analogy of the upstairs and the downstairs part of the brain. And the idea that the downstairs part of our brain is all about our basic needs. So recognising that we're breathing, recognising that we're functioning, recognising that we are getting what it is that we need to keep going. So food and drink and all those kind of things. And then the upstairs part of our brain is all about our logic and our reasoning and our functioning. And when we are in a traumatized state, it's like the upstairs brain has switched off. So we may be walking around the supermarket going, I need to buy food, but I've absolutely got no idea what to buy. I can't think past this moment of where it is that I am. Or that idea of constantly looking for safety, going into a space and saying, actually, is this space okay? Am I okay in this space? And we have all had times where we have felt, I'm not sure if this space is okay. I'm not sure if I'm welcome here. But it's that to a so much further down degree of actually deeply, deeply inside of me, things don't feel safe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I wonder, kind of, how would you say that's different with somebody with a learning disability?
So I don't think it is that different. That's a question I get asked loads, actually, Jen.
And I thought, I know that you're going to say that, because it isn't. But so often we treat it differently.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. And I actually think it's really, you can identify trauma in a person with learning disabilities with speed. So if we think about, like, just exactly as you described, so a trauma response comes from a traumatic experience. So it can be a series of experiences, or it can be one like big traumatic event, and a person experiences that event as overwhelming their capacity to regulate their own fear state. So I often think about trauma in terms of fear. So if we think, you know, maybe you are walking along the road and you'd go to cross the road and you're narrowly missed by a car, and all of your fear instincts go up. So everything you've just described, you're going to a safety mode. You're not thinking clearly or rationally. So you might find that you feel very angry, or you feel very frightened, or a bit shaken up, you might say, afterwards. And that's because your body's had this profoundly physical response to the fear, but you'll regulate. It might take the rest of the day, but you'll talk, probably tell a bunch of people, tell the story over and over again. You'll process it, and slowly you'll find that your body comes back into a regulated state, and your brain comes online, and you'll probably start to be able to rationalize what was going on. Or maybe I wasn't concentrating as much as maybe I was a bit distracted, and all that kind of stuff. And maybe the something else was going on for the driver. So you start to wrap a story around it, and that helps you to regulate your mind and your body. And that happens to us all the time in our lives. That's a totally normal experience, but a trauma experience means that you go into that fear state and you essentially stay there. So you stay at this space of fight, flight, freeze, like just in and out of those spaces. And just as you say, it's not just that the world feels unsafe, but you actually don't feel safe inside yourself. And I think one of the really fascinating things for me about somebody with a learning disability, particularly severe learning disability, when they're in that state of mind, is they have no motivation or inclination to try and hide that. Whereas if you meet someone who's traumatized, who's trying to hold down, they're holding down a job, they've got a family, they're functioning in the world, they will be putting the work in to make sure that that's not completely obvious about them when you first meet them, because they'll be having those protective and defensive functions that they can present themselves in a particular way. Somebody with learning disabilities and autism, just that is not happening. They will be like just in that fear space all the time. And so you might see them switching out of fight, where they're aggressive towards themselves or others, and then flight, where they're just desperately trying to get away from everybody, or freeze, where they just seem to shut down and there's like you just can't reach them. But those are pretty much their presentations from morning till night. And I think one of the things I notice about young people with learning disabilities who are profoundly traumatized is that, I mean, it happened to me recently. I walked into a space, had been asked to just assess a young man. I walked into the space where he was, and from the moment I crossed the threshold, I experienced overwhelming fear. Like, I experienced it. It was so uncontained in the room. He was sitting on a chair, like reclined in a chair, watching the TV. There was nothing going on. It was threatening. As soon as I laid my eyes on him, the fear that was in him, and it was totally unbearable for him, was pushed into the room. And you could see that a lot of the room, again, working really hard, but essentially everybody's dysregulated. Everybody's in a like low level fear state, and I couldn't hold it. I couldn't hold it, because it was so overwhelming in the space, and there was not a narrative of trauma around him. There was a narrative of, oh, he's autistic. He's got lots of challenging behaviors, and then just being able to change some of that narrative and say, I think you have a really traumatized young man on your hands, and therefore let's think about what he needs and what you guys need to start to help him with that.
I remember what you say about that working post-COVID and suddenly being surrounded by that kind of leaky fear from suddenly lots of people going, oh, I've forgotten what it's like to suddenly turn up to the same place every day for work or to suddenly be around 1,000 people. Because 9 months ago, I was told that being too close to one person would put them or me at risk. And now suddenly I'm around a whole host of people. And we saw within the work I was doing just a huge rise of people saying, actually, I feel frightened, but I don't know why. Or I feel angry and I don't know why. And I think that kind of that leaky aspect is really interesting because we talk about sort of a young person being incredibly afraid due to the trauma that they have experienced and how staff then can pick up on that. But it's interesting, I think, the narrative that goes alongside that, because I would hear in the mainstream world, we've never had a year seven class like this. They're the worst they've ever had. They're always fighting. They're always like this. And stuff was just labelled upon them that then when you met them, you were expecting them to be the worst 11-year-old you'd met because everybody was saying, it's terrible. They're terrible. And I think the same thing happens with some of the young people that we have worked with, some of the young people whose stories we've heard. They're always violent. That they never want to talk to us. They just hit everybody who's within reach of them. And as soon as those things start being said, the staff come in with an element of fear. And the staff come in with that, like, I'm afraid to be around this young person. And so even if there wasn't fear suddenly, it's coming from a different place as well. And so the staff are then responding from, I'm afraid to be around this young person. The young person saying, I'm afraid to be around myself. But nobody's saying this. No one's talking about it. It's just the interactions then. They're missing the connection that's needed. And it just feels so painful to watch it happen, doesn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think I've seen that happening like over and over again, where you have a child who often goes into particularly fight mode, and then you have a staff member and they walk in the door. They've just been told, "Oh, you're this young man's 1-to-1," and you can see their body is like their shoulders are up around their ears. They're like breathing sh in a shallow way, and like I've seen it happen where the child like dysregulates further in response to the staff. And so what you've got is this interaction where two people are, we talk about co-regulation. Well, co-dysregulation is a thing, and and these the staff and the young person are co-dysregulating and then spiraling into an incident. And of course the incident where the staff member gets hurt, the child is out of control, confirms the narrative that is being perpetuated, that this child is unmanageable. And and so yeah, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And none of this makes sense, or none of this is very manageable when we just think about it as like a form of autism or a challenging behavior that makes it sound like this inside the child. And
And there's no end to it. They're always going to have this diagnosis. So this behavior is always going to be here. This kind of thing. Well, of course, there's nothing that we can do. It's always like this.
And then oftentimes the response or the pack, the sort of behavioral packages are about learning essentially. So we're going to teach the child a different response. We're going to teach the child and like with different reinforcements, they will learn a different way of behaving. And of course, what we know about someone in a traumatized state is learning is not on the cards. Your learning brain is not online. All you want is safety. And that's and you we don't learn safety. We feel it or we don't. And so that then like leads into these spaces where we have young people who are highly medicated and contained.
If only there was something else that could be done, some other point to bring in. If only that safety could be created. Oh,
We did,
wait, it can.
we did say, didn't we, that we would spend some time just outlining the problem, and I feel like that's what we've done today, just on that like individual space. Like, here's another way of thinking about young people who are often labelled as like highly challenging. Here's another way of thinking about what's happening for them. And we're outlining it like this because there is also another way of responding, which is what I've spent so much time thinking about in America and since, and some of the work that we're still working on. But I feel like there's probably more to say about the organizations, teams, and the sector as a whole in terms of trauma as well before we get there, because there's a the problem is significant that we have in this space. And until we can, I feel like I've been saying this recently to some people we've been working with, until you can name the problem, you can't find the way forward. So I feel like there's more to say about the problem. But we are naming the problem so we can identify the way forward.
Absolutely. And we are beginning from that place.
Yeah. Cool. Well, more to say next time.
Indeed. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah. It's good to talk about this stuff. Thanks so much for listening today. Before you go, can you help us with something? We want to make sure these conversations reach the people who need to hear them. So if there's someone you think would benefit from listening to this, we would just love it if you shared it. See you next time.